listening to Notably Texan on 88.9 KETR. I am very excited to welcome a special guest to Notably Texan today. He's a singer-songwriter born in Temple who's been playing music for more than 40 years. He's renowned for his skills on the banjo. He cross-pollinates in several styles of music, everything from country to jazz to punk. This guy was also a founding member of the often imitated Austin trio Bad Livers. He's got more than 10 solo albums available, the latest titled Shree 108. If I'm butchering that, I'm going to have to get a confirmation from this guy. Danny Barnes joining me via telephone. How are you, Danny?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
I am wonderful. Really excited to talk to you. I've been a fan of your stuff for many years, and I kick myself year after year saying, man, I gotta line up a talk with Danny, and it's finally happened, so I'm very excited to have you live here on the show today.
Awesome.
Hey, I know you're obviously joining us via telephone. Where do we find you right now, by the way?
Well, I'm in Austin right now. I'm down here working and stuff, and I don't play tonight, but tomorrow night I play in Denton, and then I play in San Marcos. And I play another show in Austin on Saturday. So I got six shows down here, and I go to Colorado next week. And then,
nice.
So anyway, I'm bopping around a little bit.
And this
the year's starting to kind of get going. You know, it's starting to kind of move. Usually January's pretty kind of slow, and then December, January, and then things start kind of popping around now, and then they kind of hop pretty good through about November, I guess.
That's awesome. And this is a little tour in Texas you're doing with a mandolinist named Billy Bright, right?
Yeah. We play, normally I have this, my show is a electronics show with banjo. I call it Barnyard Electronics, and it's a computer show, and I play solo, and what I'm doing right now is I'm playing with my friend Billy, and we do kind of more acoustic stuff. We're doing six shows. We played in Corpus and Austin on Tuesday, and just doing a few things like that, you know.
That's great. I'm assuming that you're enjoying your time back here in Texas.
Yeah, it's nice. I come back, you know, about three times a year and stuff, and because I do about 150 shows a year domestically.
Okay.
So I get back down here probably at least twice a year or three times a year, so it's good to get back to see my friends and my family and everything.
I bet. And surely the weather's nice when you come down here. It's certainly nice right now.
Yeah, man, when I left, it was cold and wet. I live up by Seattle, and it's cold and wet and rainy, and then I go to Boulder on for two radio shows up there next week, and it'll be snowy up there.
Yeah,
so.
You're getting a little taste of everything, man.
Yeah, I had to really pack for cold and wet, for warm and for snow, so it's kind of have a thick suitcase today.
And no doubt, man. Well, Danny, I understand that you were exposed to a lot of different styles of music from your family members when you were growing up in Belton. I think you were only about 10 years old when you set your sights on the banjo after kind of being exposed to all of this different music, right?
Yeah. In 1971 is when I got, you know, found an old guy to teach me some banjo lessons and started trying to figure out how to play the thing. I'm still studying and practicing. I still practice and take lessons and work on it. That's 40 years ago, you know, 42 years ago or something.
What drew you to that unusual stringed instrument?
Well, you know, it was just a matter of, it was a big error, you know, like I didn't, like back then they only had three shows on, you know, they had those just the three networks.
Oh, right.
And in the summertime, they'd have these summertime replacement shows, and they would have these variety shows, you know, and then there was a Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour, and then the Smothers Brothers, but they had John Hartford on there.
Okay.
And I didn't realize, like, I just thought that was, like, really cool, you know, because it'd be, like, the main time of day, you know, like, say, you know, the prime time is what they used to call it. They don't play that anymore. But
right.
Have, you know, the main time when, and it'd be fade to black, and then banjo would start playing, and it would, you know, the image would come up, and it would be John Hartford playing the banjo. And
okay.
I just thought that the banjo was like the coolest thing ever, you know, and I didn't realize, you know, any other kind of socioeconomic ramifications of that or whatever. I had no idea I was 10, so I just thought, wow, it's really cool, you know, so. Got interested in it back then.
It is really a fascinating instrument. You know, I've had a lot of banjo players come into the studio over the years, and all of them recognize, you know, the unique stature of that instrument. I've had people refer to it as a, what is it? I've heard somebody call it a snare drum with a stick attached to it. I'm sure you've heard that.
Yeah, it's funny because it has, you know, it has like elements, it has rhythmic and melodic elements both, so it's kind of interesting, you know, in that sense. And it's funny, you can play it with like, you know, it fits in with an orchestra, it fits in with a country band, it fits in with a rock band,
or yeah,
all different kinds of textures. It kind of lives in its own little place, and so it's actually a pretty useful instrument, and so that's what I've always played.
Yeah, well, you have done a lot to bringing the banjo to other different styles and sounds out there. We're going to talk about that as we go on a little bit. We're talking to Danny Barnes live today here on Notably Text. And if you're just joining us, Danny, were you involved in any bands in your youth before the Bad Livers days?
Oh, I have had bands all my life.
You know, okay.
I played with old guys when I first started playing, like older men and folks around my house that played like country music and things like that.
Okay.
So that would be when I was like early 70s, when I was 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, and got into when I was in my teens, punk rock sort of exploded, and I got interested in like rock music and things like that. But I still played the banjo, and then I was in Austin through the 80s. I was in a lot of different country bands and all kinds of different things. But that was the first band that I played in that like put out records.
Yeah.
Toured and things like that. Back then, that was really something. I mean, like nowadays, like everybody has records, But back then, you had to get. It was a lot of work to put out a record,
And yeah,
it's hard and it took a lot of time, and it was a very involved process, anyway. I've had a lot of bands.
I figured that you had, and I know that the music industry has completely changed since you've been involved in it, of course, and you're just talking about putting out records. Speaking of records, I know that you've been a long fan of, and the youngsters out there are not going to know what we're talking about, but you've been a long fan of actually buying records, getting out there, discovering new sounds in the record store. I figure you probably used to spend a lot of time digging through the store's record bins.
I still spend time flipping through records.
Do you?
Whenever I go to a gig or I'm going to a job, a music job somewhere, and then like if I have a couple of hours, the first thing I do is try to find a record store, and go flip through records for a while. I'm a record fan, and
nice.
I like records, and I still buy them. And
not easy to find those stores anymore, though, is it?
it's I don't know. It's like they're there,
Yeah.
You find them and you look them up and you go. You like Waterloo Records in Austin, And
yes.
Like anymore, there's new ones opening, and stuff.
That's
like
true.
We're opening them and stuff like that. And then there's the Goodwills have a lot of records a lot of times.
Yes.
And Half Price Books and things like that. So you just kind of got to know where to look. But it's weird. It's like my friends, no one ever quit buying records. Everybody bought records the whole time. So there wasn't that weird thing of selling your records and just to have CDs and then selling the CDs just to have downloads. Like all of my friends, we've had cassette tapes and records and
sure
the whole time and never really noticed any of that stuff happening,
It's sad to me that that this whole new generation doesn't know the experience of actually going out and physically digging through the records trying to find something.
Oh,
good,
yeah.
Or just being drawn in by an album cover,
Yeah, and there's not going to be a coffee table book of great CD art,
It's like right. It's,
like there was album art.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of artists that want, visual artists that wanted to participate, in that because it was such a great canvas. I mean, the size and the dimensions of
yes.
it. It's a good canvas to be working off of, So.
No doubt about it. Yeah, it's not the same when you buy an album on MP3, to just get
yeah.
that little JPEG image of the art. It's just nowhere near
yeah.
the same. So those were the days, man. Well,
yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of real interesting bands and sort of in the avant-garde world and the punk rock world and things putting out music on cassette tapes and 45s and
even some 8-tracks, I think.
I don't. I haven't heard that, but I wouldn't be surprised. One of my friends said Cheap Trick put out an 8-track.
There is a whole revitalization of vinyl too.
I just put out a 45 last year. I got a big
oh, cool.
box of 45 records. I have in my car here. I put out records and things. And
nice.
I like to put out cassettes too. I put out tapes and 45s and things like that.
Wow.
I run a small record label out of my house of just like avant-garde weirdo music.
Weirdo music.
We put out weird things,
No, that is awesome. That's one of the things that I love about you is kind of pushing the boundaries and putting out some stuff that other folks maybe don't have the bravery to do. So
one thing that's really interesting mechanism I've noticed about it is like when you put out, say if you put out a 45, if you're like a musician or something and you put out a 45, like the only people that'll buy it are people that are really into music, And so it's kind of funny because like with CDs, there's like that mainstream sort of record buyer or music buyer or whatever who is really not into music that much.
And yes.
They're not really into it as much as like, hardcore music fans. And if you put out music on like cassette or 45, it's like the only people that buy it are like just complete rabid music fan.
No, that is true.
It's kind of interesting in that regard. You sort of weed out, like, people that complain or whatever. You know, you get rid of all those people pretty quick because no one has a turntable unless they're really, really, really into music, you know?
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it that way.
I just kind of noticed that phenomenon. It's like having a food trailer, you know? Like,
yeah.
What do you call those things?
Right. No, I know what you're talking about.
You know, like some really good taco or something like that, but it's not for everybody. But if somebody's really into it, it's like perfect for them. You know? That's kind of my model, I guess. You know?
Danny Barnes is my guest this afternoon on 88.9 KETR's Notably Texan. My name is Matt Minky. Thanks for joining us. Now, Danny, you're known by many for helping form this pioneering band with Mark Rubin and Ralph White back in the 90s. If you can, talk a little bit about the creation of the Bad Livers. How did you guys decide to actually create this band?
Well, one thing you got to remember is in 1989, you never hardly ever saw anybody with an acoustic guitar or whatever. There wasn't any of that. There wasn't like John Mayer will put out acoustic tracks, you know, and
yeah.
Things like that. Like, no one would be seen caught dead with an acoustic guitar.
Okay.
Just like in the late 80s, you know, you just did not see that. It wasn't even MTV Unplugged hadn't happened yet.
That's true.
Like, you weren't going to see, like when Eddie Vedder put out that ukulele record, that was not going to happen back then. Like when a major rock guy would do, you know, some type of acoustic thing or whatever. It just was not going to happen. It was like a whole different realm, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Everything was like really kind of, you know, mainstream country and mainstream rock and then pop music or whatever. That was like all there was. And that was a really weird move, you know? And within a few years, you know, we had interviews and, you know, articles on us in Rolling Stone and, you know, different, you know, New York Times. And we did a good job. And we had an idea, you know, we made an idea. And the idea was to have three musicians that could play a lot of different kinds of music and could play different things with very small format, you know. What we were aiming for was like a versatile small band that could play rock music and bluegrass music and Delta blues and country and, you know, avant-garde music and jazz and composed music and noise music and
sure.
You know, all different things that we enjoyed as music fans. We were basically all were music freaks, you know.
Absolutely.
That was what the idea was, because with three guys, you can, you know, if you have to, you can all stay in one hotel room, you know, two hotel rooms at the most, small
right.
band. You can make enough noise for a big band, but you only got three guys. So it's very economical. It was very creative in that you only have, you know, with three voices, you get to play a lot.
That's
know?
True, yeah.
And I was thinking about something the other day. I was watching this guy. We played in Corpus, and this feller, his name was like Reverend Fred Cook, I think was his name. He opened up, and he was a solo person. And I watched him play. And when you see the smaller the band, the more intense it is. You know, like when you have a bigger band, the audience can—they don't have to look. You know, like you can go look at the keyboard player, you can look at the horn section, you can look at the drummer, you can watch the singer, you can watch the bass player, you can look at different people.
That's true.
But like the smaller the band, the more focused it is, and the more intense it is, all the way down. And when you see someone play solo, it's pretty intense. Like, there's no relief, you know. You got to really kind of just face the music, as it were. So three people, it was also just a little more focused, you know.
And because of all the different directions that the band Bad Livers went in, there were, you know, you've got these music writers out there and stuff who were kind of obligated to try to classify stuff into certain genres. And I know the Bad Livers were tempted to be pigeonholed into things like acoustic metal, bluegrass, and thrashgrass.
Americana didn't exist.
That's true.
You know, and alt country didn't exist, and there were no terms like that. That was way before any of that happened. So it's kind of got to look at it sort of historically. It was kind of a funny time because all the stuff that's happened after that. I mean, it seems stupid to say, but like none of that had happened. So it was really strange. And like the very first record that we did was like a gospel cassette that I had a 4-track cassette machine and I did a gospel cassette.
Okay.
Just like for like my family and stuff and for friends and things. And it ended up, we decided we were just going to put it out as our first record, you know? So we were playing with like the Butthole Surfers and these different kinds of like punk rock bands. And
yeah.
And all these, because those are our friends. We're doing like metal bands and things and stuff like that. And those are our like peer group or buddies, you know, that we hung out with and stuff. It was more like just normal hip musician guys. Or
yes.
And so some of the different record labels got heard about what we were doing, and we would give them this gospel cassette, you know, which confused them greatly, you know. It's pretty, pretty funny, you know. It really confused a lot of people, which is what we were kind of like experts at, just confusing the heck out of everybody. And you know, it was kind of fun, you know. We were just all about art. And like some, you know, we just appreciated playing over people's heads as much as possible. And when, you know, there wasn't so much data back then. You know, like nowadays there's just so much data.
Yeah.
That it's a lot harder to, you know, to envision that kind of thing. It would be almost like if you wanted to participate in art in that regard, you'd have to do it not being in music, like a painter or something, or a performance artist or something, to be able to simultaneously play old music and also play over people's heads. In order to make some type of statement like that, you probably almost have to be not in music. So that's what we're, you know, sort of like the ideological sort of inspiration that we were sort of working with.
You know, looking back now, a lot of folks feel like that band really sort of paved the way for a lot of what's going on in music these days. It seems like every other band has a mandolin or a banjo or some,
right,
you know, has all of these Americana instrumentation that's either built into a rock band.
Yeah, kind of like for college kids and things like that. Like at the time, the music that like sort of like the hippie kids and the college kids were listening to was not like that.
Yeah.
I looked up, you know, avant-garde is like a style or a music that I've always been interested in. But like I read the etymology of that word is that's the people that got shot first.
Really?
They were the ones that would, you know, they'd run at the enemy and then they would get shot and then everyone else would run through and say, "Hey, we won."
Wow.
So like that's what you get for being an avant-garde musician, is you kind of bear the brunt of a lot of that, which is what we did. I mean, we were very confrontational and stuff, and we had to be, you know.
Sure. A lot of folks are still big fans of the Bad Livers recordings. I wanted to play a cut from the debut album, Delusions of Banjur, from Bad Livers. Came out in 1992. I've got this tune, Better Times, queued up here. Which, and for folks that have never heard Bad Livers music, don't assume that because you've heard one song by them that you know what the band sounds like, because you guys have so many different things out there. If folks want to hear more of your stuff, obviously they can go out there and hopefully legitimately obtain those albums. But I noticed that you've got a lot of that stuff over on the Bad Livers MySpace. That is still a thing out
there.
And
there's a bunch of live recordings on like archive.org too.
Cool.
Stream and all that stuff. So there's plenty of stuff out there.
Yeah, so if you want to hear more from the Bad Livers, since they're not an active band right now, feel free to look into their recordings. But I wanted to play this tune, Better Times. Anything that you can tell me about this one before we play it?
Well, that one kind of came out of listening to a lot of like old-time music, but also wanting to kind of make a sort of a contemporary statement out of it. The band was sort of looking at sort of like in terms of motifs and things like that, was like we didn't want to pretend like it was some other time than it actually was, and we sort of wanted to sort of present ancient American music or whatever, but like in a contemporary context. At the same time, a lot of the poetry from old American music, like Doc Boggs and Charlie Patton, things like that, has sort of a surreal quality to the poetry. It's sort of like, almost like, I'd say surrealism is a good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So, poetically, that's kind of where that thing comes from, and anyway, we worked really hard on that. And that record was produced by Paul Leary, who's the guitar player for the Butthole Surfers.
That's right.
Was a good friend of ours and a early supporter and encourager. And so that's the background on that track there.
That's great. I appreciate the insights on this one. Let's listen to this classic by the Bad Livers, Better Times. More discussion coming up with our special guest, Danny Barnes. Stay tuned to 88.9 KETR. This is Notably Texan. Here are the Bad Livers.
Can I tow your water, honey? Can I cut your cannon too?
Danny Barnes, the singer, banjo player, and primary songwriter for that old classic Texas band, the Bad Livers, is my guest today on the show. Joining me from the road, he is here in Texas right now doing a little stint of shows across the great state with a mandolin player named Billy Bright. Danny, the Livers were honored several years after breaking up with the 2007 induction into the Austin Music Hall of Fame. I assume that had to be an honor.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. I appreciate that, because we worked so incredibly hard, you know. We worked so hard. We played so many shows, and we drove in a van for so many thousands and thousands of miles.
Yeah.
We worked unbelievably hard.
Well,
and we really believed in what we were doing, and we worked really hard. So that was nice that we were recognized for that, you know.
Around the time that the Bad Livers called it quits, that was around the same time that you packed up and left Texas. Just curious, what was the impetus there as far as moving out of the state?
Well, it's from traveling. It came to be known to me that it didn't really matter where I lived, because I have to travel everywhere anyway.
Okay.
And so I just realized, I could just kind of pick where I wanted to live because I was going to have to fly to work anyway.
That's a good point.
So I really like the Northwest. My wife and I moved to the Northwest. I like the weather up there, and I like the Puget Sound area. It's really pretty, and I just like the climate. And that was where, even if I could just pick where I wanted to go, that's where I wanted to go. So
that's cool.
We moved up there, and we bought a little place, and we've been up there 16 years, I guess, and it's a really amazing place. It's really striking in its beauty, and it's funny. It's like on that side of the Cascade Mountains is it's like the west side is like a different kind of bioregion. You know, like if you look in a plant book or a gardening book or a bird book or whatever, it's like it's kind of its own. Like there's a rainforest real close by.
Oh wow!
The maritime climate, and so it's funny. It's like when you get on that side of the Cascades. Sort of a different world over there.
That's amazing. You know, I mean, we always talk about how Texas is like a whole other country, but you're really talking about a completely different kind of environment and climate up there. That's got to be a lot of fun for a native Texan to be enjoying.
Yeah, it's pretty
that.
Amazing. Yeah, it's like nice and there's plenty of rain. It's nice and fertile and
yeah,
cool. You don't have to have an air conditioner. It's like cool and just beautiful. Well, I mean, cool temperature-wise.
Yes.
And in Seattle is really, you know, there were four composers that I got to work with and I got to study with living there that really helped me get my music together. Wayne Horvitz, Bill Frisell, Avon Kang, and Robin Holcomb
were
four contemporary music composers that live in that area that I suppose there were like new music composers in Austin, but I didn't really know them or whatever. I didn't have access to folks like that.
Right.
So living up there really helped me to kind of get my music together and being able to work with people of that ilk, you know, heavy composers was really great for my work.
Now, Danny, you've been releasing solo albums since 2001, kind of blazing your own trail as an independent publisher and record label in some cases.
Right.
I'm curious, do you kind of prefer the full control and freedom of self-releasing music as opposed to working with a label?
Well, it kind of depends. I certainly do like it. It's nice to be able to put out things on your own course, you know, because the way the labels have a little bit of a problem in that, like I'm reading this novel where history stops and no one can figure out what to do and the whole world is just sort of like in neutral.
Okay.
And I feel like it's a little bit like that sometimes. Like the trouble with the label, like the cycle is usually like 18 months, you know. From when a record gets released, they kind of want to work it really hard, and then they want you to tour a certain amount of time.
Yes.
And so you can't really release records more often than every 18 months or so because you end up, they consider it to be competing with yourself or whatever.
That makes sense, I suppose.
And so it's nice to be able to just put out things as you want to and things like that. The thing about a label is if they're excited about what you're doing, they can really help you.
But right.
The trouble is they have a pretty good turnover of people that work there. So sometimes you'll get someone who's really excited about what you're doing, and maybe they work there 6 months, and then you have a 3-album deal, and then that person gets laid off.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden, you're not able to even get anybody to answer the phone all of a sudden, things like that. That happens pretty regularly. There's a pretty high turnover of people in that profession. And I don't think that world is figured out. There's always new people doing cool stuff. Like right now, there's a ton of like interesting, weirdo, small labels that really know how to do things. You know, how to create a brand identity and how to market to directly to people that are interested in it already and all this kind of stuff. But the smaller labels are a little bit lighter on their feet.
Yes.
And there's been a lot of interesting labels that have sprung up. Like, for instance, Field Hymns out of Portland. They do mostly, like, synthesizer work.
Okay.
But it's, like, newer guys. And they just have a brilliant website. And they put out a lot of great music. And they just really know how to be relevant, you know.
Cool.
But, some of the older labels that have been around a while, I don't think they've really figured out how to operate contemporaneously as well, perhaps.
Sure.
Like, for instance, they have a pretty high turnover of people that work there, you know. And so that makes it kind of difficult on my end.
No doubt. Right. Yeah. As soon as you're used to working with somebody, you call back the next time and
they're gone.
Yeah.
And they won't even take your call, you know. And so
wow.
But then you can't do – but you're contractually obliged.
Yes,
you know, and so it's kind of a funny place to be. But
I can only imagine being in that position. That obviously you appreciate the help that a label gives you and the support they give you and the word that they give you on spreading the word about your music out there. But at the same time, you got to deal with all the minutia, if you will, of dealing with.
Yeah, there's variables at play that you may not be aware of and stuff. But they'll give you a lot of help because they have a database and everything all set up. And,
right.
And a lot of times labels, like to me, the best case scenario is when you have a label that has brand identity.
Yes.
And when, because the trick is if you have a label that has such a strong identity that a fan of that label will buy something unseen just because it's on that label. If you have that type of loyalty or that type of, high level of quality of what you're doing and consistency.
Sure.
That can be especially effective, you know, because you get to sell records and play, you know, have your songs played by people who don't necessarily know who you are.
Exactly.
And I find that is like, say, if that's a variable X, say, that as time goes by, that number, the value of it is rarer, you know, because more and more people aren't really paying attention to labels so much, but there's a lot of really interesting labels that are operating in the electronic world.
Yes.
That I think really understand contemporary dynamics of how to get music out, how to collate it, how to interface with other artists and other labels and the media distribution mechanisms and all these things. You know, there's always creative, intelligent, bright people getting involved in stuff reinvigorating it and redefining it and doing it in interesting ways.
If you just
keep watching the same thing over and over again, like some business that, you know, maybe the car dealership in your town that, you know, they go under, that doesn't mean the car business is going under. That
sure.
Just they couldn't adapt and change, you know, and then there's a new place opens up and they, you know, they're a little lighter on their feet and have a little hip of brands and they kind of, you know, keep things going a little better. And, you know, that's kind of the nature of capitalism, I guess, you know?
No doubt about it, man. We're talking to Danny Barnes today, live here on 88.9 KETR's Notably Texan. Danny, how did you end up hooking up with Dave Matthews? I know that you guys did work on each other's albums around 2009.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing about my music is most of the people that are interested in what I'm doing are musicians and audio engineers and stuff.
Sure.
So it's really weird, like, If I come into New York and play, let's say 100 people come to the show, probably 60 of them are in bands.
Okay.
You know, it's like those huge, or maybe more. I mean, it's like most of the people that know what I, like if you see somebody with a Danny Barnes t-shirt on, they're an audio engineer or work in a club or they're a DJ or in a band or something.
I understand what you're saying.
So a lot of the people that are into what I'm doing are in bands. And some of the people that are into what I'm doing are in these huge bands like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, he just would come to shows and he became a good friend of mine and he's still a good friend of mine. And he's a real smart, funny, very interesting guy. And he's a big guy. For some reason, he just really likes my song.
He'll
call me on the phone, like sing my own songs to me. You know,
oh, that's voicemail cool.
And all this stuff. And he's been a very encouraging, you know, person in what I'm doing because I'm sort of, you know, I'm kind of an underground person. Like, not too many people know about me too much. I sort of am underground.
I understand.
And most of the folks that know about me, like I said, are like artists or something like that.
Sure. Now,
so he's been really, really good to me and really helped me and you know, it's like it's really amazing to play one of your own songs with that band playing you. Like I recorded a couple of things live with them where I was singing and playing. It was really fun. And anyway, he's a really cool guy, really nice man, very smart, and just a good friend of mine.
That's wonderful. And if I'm not mistaken, he's a fellow banjo player too, isn't he?
He does play banjo. Yeah, he sure does. He does play banjo.
That's cool. So, yeah, I mean, you guys obviously had the obvious connection to each other because of the common instrument there. But so, yeah, I know, like I said, I know that he backed you up on a couple of tunes on Pizza Box, and I think it was in that same year that were featured.
Yeah, he also drew the cover to that record.
Really?
Yeah, he drew that cover. If you look at his record that came out right then was Big Whiskey.
Yes.
Which I played on that record down in New Orleans. You made it in New Orleans. But the cover style, he drew that cover too. They're kind of like companion pieces.
Oh, cool.
So he drew the cover to that.
That's awesome. Well, that is one of my favorite albums. Your Pizza Box release from 2009, that genre-bending release, is one of my favorites to play here on Notably Texan. I wanted to actually get into a tune from that album called Sleep, which I believe features the aforementioned Dave Matthews on background vocals. Yeah. This one still sounds so good, even though it's, you know.
Matter of fact, his mom sings on it, too.
Are you serious?
Mom and his sister on there, too. Yeah, they were in the studio, and I just had them sing on it, too, so they're on it, and it's just a family affair, I guess.
That's very cool. That's I don't know that they're necessarily credited.
She's uncredited on the record, but she was really nice.
That is awesome. This is a really beautiful tune called Sleep by my guest Danny Barnes, featuring Dave Matthews. And as with some of these guest appearances, sometimes you got to sort of squint your ears a little bit to notice exactly where Dave's voice is in there. But if you're familiar with Dave Matthews' voice, you might be able to recognize him on the background vocals on this one. Sleep by my guest Danny Barnes, who is generous enough to stay with me and talk a little bit longer here. We're going to try to keep Danny around up until 3 o'clock today. So stick around for more discussion with my special guest Danny Barnes, and check out this great tune Sleep on your station 88.9 KETR's Notably Texan. Danny Barnes, our guest live on the telephone here on 88.9 KETR. A lot of the work that you are doing these days is what you call barnyard electronics, which is a new term to me for sure. I wonder if you can kind of describe what exactly barnyard electronics is and what does it entail?
Well, a long time ago, I grew up kind of going to the Armadillo World. Is kind of one of the Armadillo World headquarters in Austin.
Okay.
And sort of like the important thing about when I would go see shows down there, is they would have acts of different kinds on the same bill. So, like, you know how nowadays, like, they have, like, blues clubs, you know, and they have blues bands and blues record labels and
sure.
blues radio shows, and then they have, you know, reggae shows. They have reggae clubs and reggae bands and reggae record labels, and things are kind of, like, you know, differentiated in that sort of satellite radio kind of a way. You
Absolutely.
Know? But back then, they had, like, you could see all these different bands sort of play together, you know, like you might see Papa John Creech open up for Frank Zappa or something.
Wow.
You know, you saw, like, different kinds of, and I grew up just thinking that all that music all belonged together, you know. When I saw John Hartford play in probably 1975 or 76, and back then he was like a very contemporary person, artist, but yet he had done his homework in traditional music.
Okay.
So that aesthetic has always kind of impressed me and stuck with me. It's kind of like listening to all music at once, you know?
Yeah.
If a person is really well-versed in traditional American music, but at the same time, they have a good handle on like contemporary music also. And so that's kind of where I got that idea, was from watching him. So, you know, I've always tried to find my own music, you know, my own thing. And so, for me, I've gone through a lot of like punk rock music and avant-garde music and electronic music.
Yes.
Just as a music fan. So I was just trying to find an aesthetic that could be mine, you know. And so it involved learning some computer programming and things in order to build the system that I really wanted to use and stuff. So I had to kind of work on that, which took me a few years. But
sure.
It's a combination of roots American music, you know, banjo, Delta blues, bluegrass, country,
right.
and contemporary electronic music techniques.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I was trying to do. I was trying to make my own sound.
That's
what I came up with.
You've always done that for sure.
Keep your mood to yourself. Tell it to somebody else.
I actually happen to be a fan outside of this show, just in my free time. I like to listen to some sort of electronic stuff. So I can appreciate that for sure. And I thought, what an unlikely pairing, though. You know, I've certainly never heard anybody else bring banjo and electronic sounds together. So I was
You know what they say, write about what you know or whatever. You know, it's like that's kind of what I like. So as a music fan, I think a really good way of coming up with something to do is to make records that you'd want to listen to.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, combine things and come up with ideas and stuff that's interesting to you. And so rather than think, well, this is selling, let's do this because there's people buying these records. Let's play
right.
that kind of music because those records are, you know, those bands are drawing really well. So let's put a band together like that. I've never been able to really think like that. The way I've tried to think is, wow, it'd be really cool if you did this and did this and put these elements together. What would that be like? You
know? Right.
And that's the way I've sort of worked, you know.
That's great, man. I love the fact that you always have this vision of different things that you can do, and I really appreciate the diversity of what you have put together over the years. I wanted to ask you about the title of this latest album, Shree 108. I couldn't put this together on my own, so I'm hoping you can give me the Reader's
Digest
I'll make version.
I'll as quick as I can.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what it is. But like, through the years, I've sort of been very interested in philosophy since I was a kid. You know, like, I read philosophy like a lot of people would read novels or something. I've always been interested in, like, philosophy, you know. And I've spent a lot of years just reading as much of that stuff as I get my hands on, you know, various kinds of contemporary stuff and the old stuff, Greek stuff, and, you know,
okay.
the French guys from the 60s and all this stuff. Just all, you know, really been interested in philosophy. And so sometimes they have these sort of holy guys who have this metaphysical approach, and one of them is Meher Baba. I don't know if you've ever heard of Meher Baba, but he was a real brilliant guy that he was born in Pune, India.
Okay.
And he maintained a vow of silence for 40 years.
Oh, wow.
And the Who song Baba O'Reilly is sort of like somewhat of an homage to Meher Baba. A bit of a Meher Baba devotee, but anyway, Meher Baba is worth looking up. He's a very interesting fellow. He dropped his body in 1969, but anyway, he's has some amazing books and from a metaphysical perspective. So anyway, I'm on this mailing list of various Baba followers all over the world, and you know they talk about different parts of the book and different parts of his various books, I should say, and different things and a lot of pictures of him, and just he's a real interesting fellow to study. And so anyway, I realized at one point in my life that I had this email of this guy. His name is Bao, B-H-A-U. Bao just passed away. He was very old. He ran the Meher Baba Trust and was just Meher Baba's right-hand man and his night watchman and knew Baba very well. And so I realized at one point that I had Bao's email. And so, which would be sort of like analogous to having like Matthew or Peter's email or something.
Yeah.
You know, like somebody who was right there with this holy man and you,
sure.
all of a sudden you realized you had access to him. So I sat down for a couple of days and I composed this one or two page email that asked like every question that I could think of that had sort of plagued me since I was a little kid. Things like, what is the nature of reality? You know, like why is the material world an illusion? You know, why are good people suffer so much and why are bad people allowed to prosper so much? And why is that? You know, what mechanism would allow that to happen? You know, and just all these questions of, you know, all the stuff that's, you know, I've been looking for answers for since I was a little kid.
Sure.
And so I hit send and I never expected to hear back from him. Because it's, you know, he's like very old and was really sick and stuff. And
okay.
He gets thousands of emails a day or whatever, probably. Anyway, so about a day later, bing, my little email thing goes off. And I look at it, he'd written me back.
Wow.
And I opened it up and it said, Dear Shree Shree 108 Danny Barnes. That was what he would call. And I started this sort of email, like we sort of had we're pen pals for a while, and he would always call me that, Shree Shree 108 Danny Barnes. I even asked him what it meant, but. Anyway, he said, I can tell from reading your email that you're a philosopher.
Okay.
He says, you wouldn't have been able to write a short email because you have this philosophy of yours. And he says, in regards to all your questions that you have, just forget it. The answer to this won't help you.
Wow.
Just love Baba and that's enough, you know. And so
okay.
It was really amazing experience because you know, he really sort of, he gave me the answer I was looking for. It was pretty awesome.
That's
amazing.
I haven't
told anybody about that because the story's too complicated to really tell. But anyway, that's where that came from. And so he would call me that, and I even asked him, I said, Balji, why are you calling me Sri 108? He would say, well, I couldn't call you Sri 107, and I couldn't call you Sri 109. It had to be 108, you know. And
okay.
Anyway, it's silly, but
nice.
That guy meant a lot to me, and I thought I was anyway, it made me really happy when he answered my question.
No kidding. Well, obviously, that touched you and meant enough to you to put that as the title of your latest album. Folks can get a hold of this in various forms out there. I know they can reach out to you on Bandcamp. You've got the album available in various forms and places out there. And
that's right.
This is one that I assume that you're not necessarily pushing hard to radio per se. This has got a kind of a lot of experimental stuff on there, so I would call
this.
Yeah,
it's really just I'm just pretty much sold it directly to my fans and my mailing list.
That's great,
and it's pretty much available as a download from Bandcamp, and you can download whatever kind of file you want. That's
yes,
what about Bandcamp, you can get a high res file if you like.
I know.
It's a pretty neat. Interface.
It is. I have actually discovered a lot of great artists there, and it's real easy to interact, not just for a DJ such as myself. That's how I reached out to Danny, but it really is
a great way. It's really easy to share stuff, too. You know,
yeah.
you can stream the whole thing, and it's a pretty good model for future music sales, I think. They're really onto something really great, I think.
I agree with you there, man. Folks can look into Bandcamp. They can look it up Danny Barnes, who is playing tomorrow night in Denton at Dan Silverleaf. And I can't thank you enough for spending this entire hour with me. I can't believe we are already
no
out
problem.
Of time, man. This has been a blast. And I wanted to talk to you about public radio, but I've only got about 30 seconds left. So you'll just have to come into the studio sometime and talk to me again, all right?
No problem. Love to do it.
Hey, I'm going to play you out with just a little bit of I Ain't Hardly Worth Fixing, one of my favorite tunes off of Sri 108. And big thanks again to Danny Barnes for being my special guest today. Have a great afternoon, my friend.
I don't mind if you hear what you're saying to me.